I'm happy to have Jim Owen here to do our next talk, the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System, History, Construction, Operations, and Future. Jim has a Bachelor's of Science in Biological Sciences with minors in Chemistry and Economics from South Dakota State University. He's been working in the water treatment industry for over 20 years and has worked for Lewis and Clark since 2007. He's responsible for the water supply, treatment, and distribution of potable water. He also works extensively with engineers, contractors, and suppliers on the design and construction of pipelines, pump stations, and reservoirs. So please help me welcome Jim Owen.
Thank you, Ole, and thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and tell the Lewis and Clark story in Minnesota. When I give talks in South Dakota, everybody is pretty aware of the Lewis and Clark water system and the importance of it, but we're just starting to deliver water now in Minnesota, and we really appreciate the opportunity to get the word out and continue to educate folks like you, especially in the industry, who can appreciate treated water and all that it brings to communities and individuals across the states. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary as a corporation last year. We started way back in 1990 as the Southeast South Dakota Water Supply System. And back then it was 53 members, and they ranged from the city of Fairmont all the way over to Chamberlain, South Dakota. And it was all these communities that came together to try to address water quality and quantity needs in a regional basis. And the topic of the theme for the conference was advances in groundwater, and certainly Lewis and Clark and the regionalization approach that we have, that we bring to the table, is something that I think we're going to see more and more across the country. I'm really thankful that Southeast South Dakota Water Supply System got shortened up to Lewis and Clark Regional Water. It wouldn't fit very well on my jacket today. Currently, the project membership is made up of 20 member systems, and you can see the Minnesota folks there, cities of Worthington, Laverne, Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water System, and Rock County Rural Water System. And, you know, I get a question frequently, is why are you importing or why are you delivering water to the land of 10,000 lakes? You're taking water from South Dakota and pumping it into Minnesota. That just seems counterintuitive. But you geologists out there know that that southeast corner of the state is very, very short in water resources. Very shallow aquifers, in some cases contaminated aquifers. Most of the cities that we deliver water to in rural water systems, if there's a drought, they have big problems that they just find it really difficult to manage. I like to throw out the fact, and someone I'm sure in this room will correct me that I'm wrong, but Rock County in southwest Minnesota is the only county in Minnesota that doesn't have a naturally occurring lake. That's a talking point I've been using for years. And Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water, they have multiple systems spread out through a 13-county area in southwest Minnesota, and they really need the water. We're just starting to deliver water to them, and I'll talk a little bit about their system. This is our system map, and we started construction of our system in 2004, and it wasn't until 2012 that we actually started delivering water. And the focus of our construction for a number of years was our well field down here on next to the Missouri River, raw water pipeline, then our water treatment plant, and then 50-some miles of 54-inch pipe up to the Sioux Falls area, and then associated pump stations, reservoirs, things like that. But this is our system map and the build-out that we anticipate. We're currently delivering water over by Magnolia, the city of Magnolia, and we still have to extend our pipelines to the city of Worthington, and then we have these pipelines planned to get down to Sibley, Iowa, and this pipeline will extend from our main transmission line over to northwest Iowa and ultimately hook up the cities of Sibley, Sheldon, and Hull, Iowa. A little bit of pipe here yet to be constructed. I say a little bit, it's actually 42 miles of pipe yet to be constructed from Sioux Falls heading north up to the city of Madison. a little bit of background. And as I talk, I kind of jump around between, you know, the history of the project, the construction of the project, the funding of the project, and I throw in some cool construction photos too, just to keep it interesting. Lewis and Clark, of course, is critical to improving the quality of life and expanding economic development in the tri-state area. We're a nonprofit wholesaler provider of water. Most rural water systems that you talk to, they have thousands of individual hookups and thousands of miles of pipe. And on disconnect day, they're turning off hundreds of people. For us, it's we only have 13 members getting water right now, and to date, everybody has paid their bill. We were incorporated in 1990, as I mentioned, as a system. We spent 10 years on Capitol Hill trying to get authorization in Congress and finally achieved that in the year 2000. Generally speaking, our funding is 80% federal, 10% states, and then 10% from the local members. We're owned and governed by the 15 cities and rural water systems that we're delivering water to or will deliver water to. Our service area, when it's complete, is going to be about 5,000 square miles, which is the size of Connecticut. And I mentioned the series of wells that we have next to the Missouri River. This is a section of our raw water pipeline actually coming up out of that Missouri River Valley. And this is a 54-inch pipe. And the reason we're up out of the valley, of course, is because that valley could be a floodplain at some point in the future. So our water treatment plant is located about 9 miles from our well field. As I mentioned, we started delivering water to the first 11 members in 2012. Those of you that remember 2012 was a drought year. And the city of Sioux Falls, they buy about 80% of our water on a daily basis. And in July of 2012, the drought was getting so severe in that area that they were going to have to seriously curtail industry from using water in the city of Sioux Falls. And we were fortunate to be able to bring our water treatment plant online that July and relieve the city, in effect. The city of Sioux Falls blends our water with their own water sources. Lewis and Clark is the long-term answer for the city of Sioux Falls growth model, well out 50-plus years. Our system is being built for 45 million gallons a day with an expansion planned all the way up to 60 million gallons a day. Of that 45 MGD, Sioux Falls is reserved 28 million gallons. And I mentioned 13 members are receiving water now. This is our water treatment plant. It was a state-of-the-art as of 2012, and this was the ribbon-cutting ceremony that we had that July. I mentioned Rock County Rural Water. They were hooked up in 2015, their first connection. And Lewis and Clark is a very needed water source for Rock County Rural Water. Their well field next to the Rock River is very susceptible to drought. Laverne was connected in this past March. And in September, we finished the Magnolia Meter Building, which is a joint connection, a second connection for Rock County Rural Water, and a first connection with Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water. Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water is so desperate for this water at this connection that they're currently building 22 miles of pipeline, a pump station, and a reservoir to get their pipelines down to Magnolia to tap into this connection. Lincoln Pipestone serves 13 counties in southwest Minnesota, over 50 individual towns and communities, in addition to all the rural homeowners and farmers that they serve. The way I understand it, the Lewis and Clark water supply is going to relieve pressure on Lincoln Pipestone system from the areas of Laverne and Magnolia all the way north to Montevideo or Montevideo, depending upon how you pronounce that word. Sorry. This is a pipeline that we're laying in a city park just on the edge of Laverne. Be careful when you go down this slide. So our population served, it's a little over 200,000 right now. When we're fully complete, it'll be over 300,000. It's a big deal in southeast South Dakota, southwest Minnesota, and northwest Iowa to be able to serve that many people with a reliable source of water. Right now, we have about 156 miles of pipeline in the ground, and we'll have over 300 miles when we're complete. Our average day so far has been about 14.6 million gallons delivered from our water treatment plant, and our peak day this past July was about 22 million gallons. I mentioned the groundbreaking that we had to spur construction. We had that down at the Missouri River. We're currently 67% complete. The 20 members in three states prepaid 100% of their local share, which was in excess of $154 million. And then the federal share, which was authorized by Congress, has been coming in dribs and drabs lately. So our construction was entirely dependent upon federal appropriations to advance the pipelines into southwest Minnesota, northwest Iowa. Since 2009, everybody knows what happened in 2008 in this country. Well, since that kind of dried up our federal funding source, we did get a big investment of stimulus dollars when the stimulus program came through with President Obama. But since 2009, our federal funding has come in dribs and drabs for construction. On the operations side, we're fully funded through the water rates that we charge our members. But on the construction side, it's federal dollars that we use to make those capital investments. So 2011, 2013, our construction, engineering, and easement acquisition were at a standstill, which just caused all sorts of heartburn among the Minnesota membership and the Iowa membership to know that the South Dakota members are receiving water, but because of federal funding shortfalls, we were not able to advance construction into southwest Minnesota and meet the critical water needs that these communities had. We had no choice but to go back to the states. Remember, the states had already had a local share, 10% in the project. They'd already paid. We had to go back to the states and ask them for federal funding advances to keep construction moving forward. These are zero interest loans that will be paid back at an undetermined time in the future once all 20 members are connected, using federal funding as the repayment. The federal government has never reneged on a water project. Once you get authorization, your project will be built. You may not be able to stand the timeline. You might even be dead before the federal government can fulfill their obligation. And as I said, it caused a lot of consternation and heartburn for the members in southwest Minnesota and northwest Iowa to see this great piece of infrastructure serving 11 members when there's still 9 members not receiving the water. So, believe it or not, we actually had success with this approach. Zero interest loan at undetermined payback time. This is a meter building just outside of, Adrian, Minnesota. It's on the Iowa-Minnesota border. This is a dual facility. We're actually delivering water to the community of Rock Rapids, Iowa, and Rock County Rural Water. We had to do something innovative in South Dakota, too. I mentioned the city of Madison, kind of hanging out there with 42 miles of pipeline yet to be built to get to Madison. And we went to the state of South Dakota and talked about federal funding advance to build this stretch of pipe, 42 miles. And the state of South Dakota looked at it really hard, looked at all the rural water systems that are out here. Some of them are members of the Lewis and Clark system, and came up with a somewhat innovative approach where they advanced us $8.7 million to construct 2 5-mile segments. That's on the northernmost segment coming out of Madison, and then the southernmost segment attached to our transmission line and going north to a pump station that's under construction. And that would allow us to tap into a couple of rural water systems. We're delivering a little extra water to one of our members so they can free up some capacity from their own system to serve Big Sioux Rural Water System. And then that rural water system would deliver up to 1 million gallons a day to the city of Madison and tide them over for up to 20 years until Lewis and Clark funding comes in to actually complete these stretches of pipe between. In Minnesota, because of the great support that we have in your elected leaders, through the bonding bill, we were able to secure a $22 million advance in 2014 and a $19 million advance in 2015 to construct infrastructure in Minnesota. The funds were used to construct the line from the Iowa-Minnesota border north to Laverne and then and east some distance to Adrian, Edwards Avenue, if you're familiar with that part of the state. We asked the state of Minnesota for the final federal funding advance of $11.5 million during the 2017 session to complete the line. We had it in the bonding bill in FY16, and those of you that know what happened to the bonding bill in the legislature at the end of the last session. The bonding bill never did get passed. But if all goes as planned, Worthington will be receiving water sometime in 2018. Huge thanks to Governor Dayton and the legislative leaders. And we're still trying to secure an advance from Iowa. It's a little more difficult down there. They don't have the funding mechanisms in place. It's not from a lack of support. They just don't have the right mechanisms in place to allow us to take advantage of it. We like to say we're standing on the shoulders of giants with the Lewis and Clark system. Like I said, we've been a corporation for 26 years now, and the first 10 of that was just planning, and working with elected leaders. And if I started naming all the names of the congressional folks and senators, I'm sure I would leave somebody out, so I don't even try to touch that. Just know that, you know, in Minnesota, back in the day, it was Wellstone and Coleman, and now it's Franken and Klobuchar, and they're champions of the Lewis and Clark Project. This is one of the first sections of a 24-inch steel pipe in Minnesota. And on a truck, you can get 9 sections of these 24-inch steel pipe, and each section's about 40 feet long, so it takes a lot of trucks to get a mile of pipe. This guy has the worst job in the world. This young man, his name's Clinton Kane. He has crawled through, I bet, over 100 miles of Lewis and Clark pipeline over the years. And that little device that he's using is just checking to ensure that the pipe is round. Steel pipe with a mortar lining, you would think it would be robust, but you can actually overcompact soil on top of it when the pipeline's being placed and egg-shape the pipe, which is a bad thing. So Clint goes down this little, he lays on this little skateboard contraption, and he goes through each section of pipe to verify the roundness of the pipe, and also to ensure that each joint of the pipe has been adequately grouted. This is mortar-lined pipe, so each stick, each segment needs to be mortar-lined to ensure that no steel is exposed on the inside of the pipe. Clint's about 6'3". He weighs about 160 pounds. I keep telling him if he gains any weight, we're going to have to look for somebody else. It's a little bit of riprap that we did along the Rock River. This is a tributary, actually, here that runs into the Rock River. And our pipe is actually buried here, and then it goes underneath the Rock River. This map of the Minnesota construction facilities. So we've delivered water now to Laverne. We actually have awarded a contract to build a pump station south of Laverne and a reservoir south of Laverne. This pump station then will pump water through this pipeline to a reservoir yet to be built just outside of Worthington. The infrastructure is in place up to, it's in place up to Magnolia, and this is under contract now to build a 10-mile stretch of 24-inch pipe and then a 2-mile stretch of 12-inch PVC pipe to get to Lincoln Pipestone's second connection. Federal funding status for Lewis and Clark, it's kind of a sad story. There's 6 Bureau of Reclamation authorized rural water program projects in the nation. There's 2 in Montana, 2 in New Mexico, 1 in North Dakota, and then Lewis and Clark. The president, we're a line item in the president's budget, and he only proposed $26.26 million in the FY16 budget for overall rural water program construction. So of those 6 projects, $26 million and $2.7 million specifically for Lewis and Clark. Bureau of Reclamation report shows that even if $50 million is appropriated annually, they're not keeping up with inflation. All these projects have an authorized federal ceiling that gets indexed every year for inflation. So every year that you're not overcoming the inflation index, the cost of the project goes up. And we see that in this chart here. Even if $50 million is appropriated annually, assuming 4% inflation, the remaining federal cost share is going to increase on these 6 projects from $1.4 billion to $1.8 billion by 2065, which is a path to infinity. We like to talk about the economic impact of having an abundant water source. And this is a dairy. The area that we're serving water to is industrial agriculture and individual producers, and they all need a reliable source of water. This dairy, 4,200 head of cows is inside this dairy. tremendous need for water. Sioux County, Iowa, they have the highest density of hogs per capita of any county in the country. Agriculture is the main industry in this part of the country that that we're delivering water to. And to the extent that we can have an impact there and provide or help provide, you know, economic opportunities for individuals and communities, it's a great success story. The Tri-State Congressional Delegation worked hard to secure additional funding for Bureau of Reclamation's Rural Water Program, bringing the FY16 total to 65.5. The Bureau of Reclamation ultimately brought up Lewis and Clark's FY16 total to $9.54 million. Remember I said the President's budget, he allocated or penciled in $26 million for the six rural water programs. The Tri-State Congressional Delegation, South Dakota, Iowa, and Minnesota, Senator Klobuchar, Franken, Grassley, Ernst, Senator Thune, and Senator Rounds all worked hard, as well as the congressional folks, to plus that number up to $65 million. So it went from 26 to 65. And those six senators all worked hard to plus it up for Lewis and Clark. And of that total, we only got $9.54 million. Some fairly entertaining footage is Senator Franken taking the Bureau of Reclamation Commissioner to task in the hearings in Washington. It's almost an annual event, and Senator Franken does a really good job of tearing into the Bureau of Reclamation Commissioner. So for FY17, we're unsure what we're going to get from the federal government, and what we do is we use these federal dollars as a cost share with the states with these federal funding advances to try to advance construction. Like I said, the congressional delegations worked tirelessly to secure additional funding for Lewis and Clark. To date, we've awarded $342 million in construction projects, about 42 individual construction projects over the last 12 years or so. We're 67% complete and hopefully get to 72 by the end of next year. There's still $200 million worth of construction remaining in the three states. Talk a little bit about our source. That's the conference topic is groundwater. And this is a map of South Dakota. The Missouri River cuts right through the middle of it, and then when it gets down here, it actually touches the border of South Dakota and Nebraska. And Lewis and Clark is way down here in the corner. This is actually Mulberry Point. This is a free-flowing stretch of the Missouri River. You go upstream of Yankton, which is about 20 miles upstream of our well field. That's the last dam on the Missouri River system. So this is a free-flowing stretch of the river. On any given day, it's making and eroding these sandbars down here. It doesn't lend itself to an intake going out into the surface of the water because of that sandbar and the nature of erosion and formation of those sandbars. So we have a series of wells that are tapped into the aquifer that underlies that area. This is glacial material, riverbed aquifer material. It's a really great source of supply for the Lewis and Clark system. We worked extensively over the last couple of years with South Dakota Geological Survey to come up with this delineation, this area of influence for our aquifer, so that we could work with the county and the city of Vermilion to come up with some zoning ordinances to try to protect that aquifer. And we're actually successful after, I think it was 10 hearings through various government bodies to achieve that. Let's see, we actually had to do a bank stabilization project about a mile stretch of the Missouri River. It's very highly erodible because it's that full force of the Missouri is coming down and slamming into this Mulberry Point, so we armored that bank to protect our well field infrastructure. The Missouri River is really the greatest natural water source in South Dakota, and if you're going to build a water system like the Lewis and Clark system, you have to go where the water is and have a source of supply that's abundant and drought resistant. And basically where we're at, the Missouri River is basically unaffected by drought conditions. It's never had an issue in recorded history where the river's dried up or anything like that. So on any given day, there's about 22,000 cubic feet per second going past Mulberry Point. That's the average flow going past Mulberry Point. And if we were pulling 45 million gallons a day out of the aquifer, that'd be less than about 0.1% of the average daily flow going past Mulberry Point. We have 11 wells, and right now we can deliver up to 36 million gallons a day with plans to add wells as our needs increase. Excellent formation, I mentioned, 2,800 gallons a minute from an individual well. I mean, that's just almost unheard of, and it's a huge asset for the tri-state region. Our deepest well is about 140 feet, and the shallowest is about 80. Four of our wells are drilled at an angle, a 24-degree angle. And this is one of those wells that was being drilled in 2003. It's actually an 18-inch diameter well casing going down with an 18-inch screen. In this particular well, it's about 242 feet long at that 24-degree angle, which equates to a vertical distance where the screen is at only about 90 feet, something like that, in overall depth. And the theory behind an angle well is it allows you to put more feet of screen in the aquifer than a vertical well would alone. In this particular well, we have 80 feet of screen. This is the column pipe and pitless that was going in 2011, just before our system started up. And this was a week ago that pitless was coming out again because this well needed to be rehabilitated. We'd noticed a precipitous decline in specific capacity. So we worked with Lane Christensen Company to pull this well, and they're doing some bore blasting, they call it, to try to loosen up any incrustation or anything like that that we may have on the screen. Actually, what we found is that this well seems to be bringing in some sand. This well, when they drilled it, they didn't bring in gravel pack. They're utilizing the existing gravel pack. And what we're finding is we're bringing in some sand through the screen, even though we aren't over-pumping this well. So it'll be interesting to see long-term how well these angle wells hold up for us. This is a 150-horsepower motor and pump, and this pump can do about 2,200 gallons a minute, something like that. We have seven vertical turbines down in this well field, and this is kind of a typical installation for us. We have a well house, and inside this well house is a vertical turbine pump. And inside the house also is the motor starters, or VFDs, variable frequency drives, for other wells. So there's a vertical turbine in this vault here, and then everything is backed up by standby generation in the event of power outages. Here they're pulling one of those vertical turbines in that vault, and they've already pulled the motor, and now they're pulling the pump. And then there's the multi-stage pump columns that we use. And then something that's kind of interesting is this shroud. It hangs below the pump, and you can see the holes in this shroud actually control the rate of flow through the screen at various locations, so that you don't get the majority of your flow from the top of the screen. It actually spreads it out through the length of the screen. This is a glamour shot of our water treatment plant. Anybody have a rural acreage where they overfly it and then try to sell you a picture? In our case, they took our picture, and then they made these nice blue lagoons that are just beautiful. They're actually full of yellow lime sludge and covered with weeds right now. And I actually have so much dirt on the top of my building that I could probably grow corn on top of that building. They did a really nice job. Conventional lime softening water treatment plant is what we have with gravity filters. Water quality, we're blessed actually with the raw water that we have, 300 parts per million or so of total hardness. The iron is fairly high at 3.5 parts per million. Those of you, I'm sure most of you are familiar, if you have iron levels like that, if you fill up a glass of that water and put it on the shelf very quickly, it's going to turn brown. And by the time it's treated through our water treatment plant, it's basically at the level of detection of the instruments for the iron and manganese level. And then the softening process that takes place reduces it down to about 150 parts per million. Excellent water quality by regional standards, certainly. Most of our members would kill to have water quality like this. This is a section of our 54-inch pipe leaving the plant. And actually what he is doing is it's this accordion-type deal, or this spring deal, is actually connected to a little device. And what he's checking is the paint coating on that piece of pipe to ensure that there aren't any imperfections in that paint coating that are going to cause corrosion. You think about a steel pipe going in the ground, corrosion is relentless and it's going to start working on it. And what we do is we do an impressed current cathodic protection system, where you're putting a low voltage current on your steel pipe to overcome the natural corrosive forces of the soil. It's the same technology that the oil and gas industries have used for many, many years with success to protect steel pipe that's placed in the soil. The first 11 miles of pipe leaving our water treatment plant, it was the thickest walled pipe because our pumps are so big in our water treatment plant and the pressure is so high. We're pumping water uphill to the Sioux Falls area. There's over 300 feet of elevation change from our plant up to the Sioux Falls area. 50 some miles, 300 feet of elevation change. Before we move one drop of water from our water treatment plant, we have to overcome about 140 psi of pressure coming back at us. So the first 11 miles, the wall thickness of that pipe was about a half inch, the steel, and then another half inch of concrete mortar lining. 11 miles of pipe, $33 million. Very expensive pipe. Large ground storage reservoirs outside of Sioux Falls. Each one of these is 7.5 million gallons. And then a repumping station that sits between those reservoirs. This repumping station can pump up to 45 million gallons a day to a water tower that sits on the south end of Sioux Falls. This water tower is 190 feet tall. And you want to use topography to your advantage. So this is a high point for about 5 counties. Water that's in this water tower can flow by gravity all the way to Adrian, Minnesota. It's about 40 miles away. This is just another snapshot of our system. So we've talked about this transmission line and then the repumping station that we have here and then a water tower and then the construction in Minnesota. We purchase permanent easement for our pipelines. So we work with landowners, and we have a formula to compensate them for allowing us to place our pipelines on their land. And by the time our formula has run its course, they essentially get compensated for 90% of the value of the land that we disturb, and then they get to farm over that pipe. This stretch of pipe is being welded, and he's actually doing an inspection on that weld. This is crossing the interstate south of Magnolia. We board the interstate, and then the pipeline is run through a carrier pipe or casing. This is just inside the city of Magnolia. And then this is a structure that we built to deliver water to this water tower, which says Magnolia, but it's actually owned and operated by Rock County Rural Water. And then this is a dual metering facility as well with Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water System. Here's a kind of a snapshot of yet to be constructed. It's ends up being about 15 miles or so of pipe to get to Worthington, yet to be bid and awarded. We start to reduce our pipelines in size. We start out at 24, then we go down to 20, then we go down to 16 before we ultimately get inside Worthington city limits. And that's kind of the end of the line. This dish head allows us to attach gauges, things like that, and pressure test that pipeline to ensure that the integrity of the pipeline is where it should be. The future of the Lewis and Clark system, it's just going to be continued growth from our standpoint, more pipeline construction to hook up the members. Hopefully we get to Worthington by 2018. The Iowa members, the best that we can hope for is by 2025 right now, unless something changes with the Iowa legislature. We still need that $200 million to finish construction. I'd like to reinforce the point that if you build it, they will use it. Over the past 3 years, we've seen double-digit increases in water use from the connected members. They're finding new and innovative ways to use the water. And, of course, we'll be adding more wells as necessary. Mentioned construction in Iowa. It's going to be fairly difficult. There's this stretch of pipe heading south of the pipeline that will go to Worthington. This stretch of pipe is 4.5 million and then 6.3 million to get in Iowa construction. And the state of Iowa has said point blank that no state funds can be used outside of the state of Iowa. So it's difficult to overcome that, especially when we have this stretch down here of $29.5 million pipeline in South Dakota before we get to the Big Sioux River and cross over into Iowa. This is my last slide. It's the pipe to somewhere. At the end of this pipeline, City of Worthington is patiently waiting for the water. They've been a member of the Lewis and Clark system since 1990, and here it is 26 years later, and they're still waiting for the water, but it's getting closer every day. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thanks so much. That was an awesome presentation. And I think I finally can put to bed the conspiracy theory that I've been hearing that this is just a black ops to bring Lake Superior water to the Southwest U.S., just the first leg of that. That's not true.
That's not true.
Okay, no. Great. Thanks, Jim.
Interestingly, the Bureau of Reclamation, their mission is bringing water to the West. This is the first Bureau of Reclamation water project in Minnesota.
Yeah, you said you had a problem with overcoming that building a lineup in Minnesota from Iowa. I suppose you can't tell us how you overcame that.
A problem? Sorry?
No Iowa money spent outside of
how did you fund it?
Yeah, so that's where we have to wait for federal funding to catch up.
I see.
Yep. Sorry.
I have a question regarding Lewis and Clark. When I first started in DNR in 92, it was very soon I heard about the Lewis and Clark project being proposed. So it's been a long time in wait. Question I had is twofold, is how you bill for the water, like how much, and is it equally distributed, or is it depending on how far you are from the source, and were there any problems created as a result of water being appropriated in an area of Western water law being pumped into an area of Eastern water law? Just curious if that played into the equation.
I can't speak to the water law issue. I know there was some concerns about crossing some continental divide and some watershed and taking water from the Missouri watershed and transporting essentially to the Mississippi watershed. But that all was hashed out long before my time. Regarding the water rates, as you might understand, we spend a lot of time looking at water rates. We have a 20-member board, and they all have various opinions about how much it should cost. And water, you're right, water is more expensive at the end of the line than it is for the first few customers just because of the repumping expense that we have. But our board and their wisdom have come up with one water rate for all the members. Everybody pays the same rate, and it's actually a step rate. The first step, each member, they have an allocation on paper. All of our water's fully allocated among the membership, and it's a step rate. So for the first 25%, which they have to buy, whether they use it or not, it's one rate, and then it actually gets a little bit cheaper after that. That first 25% captures the vast majority of our operations, maintenance, and reserve contribution expenses.
I have a question. You know, you have the projected use of, I think it was 45 million gallons a day or what have you. With the increasing agricultural production in that area, do you ever see a point in the distant future where the use is going to outstrip your source of supply? You can keep putting in more wells. Excuse me, but that's the same thing that happened to some of the water utilities out in that area. You're going to have to move into more emphasis on conservation, do you think, in the future?
City of Sioux Falls has done an excellent job on water conservation. They have a great story to tell. Over the last 10 years, they've added about 30,000 residents to that community. Right now, the population is about 170,000. So you can appreciate the impact of 30,000 more residents over the last 10 years. Their average water use per day per person has actually went down. So their average day is still where it was 10 years ago. The gallons consumed per person per day or used per person per day across industry, including industry, it's about 117 gallons per person 10 years ago. Now it's down around 105, something like that. So conservation has been very successfully implemented in Sioux Falls. Getting back to your earlier question of the source being, being fully utilized, and certainly we've seen that our members, many of our members wish they would have reserved more water from the Lewis and Clark system. Like I said, on paper, all of our water is fully allocated up to that 45 million gallons a day. There's no, there's not much of a reserve there. We can expand our system up to 60, but there's many systems that we've connected that are already using on a daily basis more than they reserved from us. And one of the things that we lament is the fact that when we got easements to install our pipelines originally, We should have put in for two pipelines, something like that, or a clause to allow us to construct two pipelines in the future. But I can see once we're fully built out, the members are going to have to institute conservation measures if they haven't already, because it's not a limitless supply, obviously. That was one of the first things that the Lewis and Clark system did, was procure abundant water rights from this Missouri River aquifer. Water rights are a big deal in South Dakota. I know it's a little different system in Minnesota, but in South Dakota, it's first in time, first in line. So if you have a water right, you have preference over just about anybody else or any industry that may come in and want to put a well in your aquifer. And the Big Sioux Aquifer, which is the primary source of supply for the city of Sioux Falls, is fully allocated. You can't get a water right. In fact, they had to buy an 80-acre parcel of land from a landowner this was about 15 years ago. They had to spend $2 million for an 80-acre parcel of ground to get a 500-gallon-a-minute water right. So water rights are a big, big deal. And like I mentioned, the Big Sioux Aquifer is fully allocated. It's very susceptible to drought conditions, and along with the Big Sioux River. The Big Sioux River is also a source of supply for the city of Sioux Falls. In the last 30 years, it's gone dry twice. Does that answer your question?
I'm also curious about downstream, whether what you're taking out.
Yeah, and I mentioned the average daily flow going past Mulberry Point was 22,000 CFS. It's less than 0.1% of what we'll withdraw from the river. So it hasn't been an issue, not yet.
Well, then looking upstream, the Corps of Engineers controls the water through the rest of South
Dakota. The Corps of Engineers is like a dirty word in South Dakota.
Yeah, even more so in North Dakota. I'm just wondering how they didn't have any control over your use of the water. That was not an issue. First part. Second part is, any long-term likely use of the upper Missouri for uses west that might start to deplete the 99.9% going by you?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, certainly the whole state of South Dakota is essentially served by water from the Missouri River now. There's some really big water systems on the western part of the state, Miniwichone, Miniwaste, that get almost all the way to the western corners of the state. And then on the east side, there's Mid-Dakota water system and Webb water system, and now Lewis and Clark, that serve the vast majority of eastern South Dakota. And it's a united front between these systems when there's any talk about using the Missouri River resource in ways that we wouldn't necessarily agree with. Does that answer your question?
Well, it's a bigger question probably than you wanted to answer, I know.
I try to avoid the politics if at all possible. That's not my job. I'm busy enough. Well, that's a good question. The dam at Yankton has to maintain a certain amount for power generation. And I want to say it gets down into the teens, like 13,000, 14,000, I think that's probably the lowest that's been recorded. Oh, yes. Yep. It's a vast, vast bucket, and we're just one little drop.